Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharakana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharakana Feliciano. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Today, we are joined by our guest, Elaine T. Jones.
Elaine T. Jones is a graduate of Drexel University and Temple University. She is a retired educator, business owner, fashion designer, community worker, and motivational speaker who began her writing career after her four daughters were adults. Aunt Doncy's Trunk is a book that was always in Elaine's head. Because she is now the family matriarch, she felt compelled to make sure the record was clear and understandable about the foundation and development of her family. Elaine hopes the story of her family will help the reader have a better understanding of the trials and tribulations their ancestors suffered in yesteryear, respect the opportunities offered to them today and tomorrow, and learn from the life experiences of others. Welcome to Speak On It, Elaine.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I appreciate the time to spend with you.
Awesome.
Awesome. Yeah, we're so happy to have you. So let's just go ahead and get started. Elaine, can you please share with our listeners what inspired you to write Aunt Doncy's Trunk?
Well, after I retired, I realized that I had time. At least I could have started before, but I didn't think I had the time. And all my children and relatives were asking me questions since I was the older in the family. And I said, okay, let me just write these things down. And I started just writing them down for the family. And I would let someone read it. And they said, this is really interesting. So I realized there were other people interested in what our family had accomplished as well. So that's why the book got started. It actually took me 10 years to write the book because I wanted to make sure that I was absolutely correct on everything that I remembered. So I tried to get family and friends that I knew at that time to give me their insight on what their memories were. And it took me 10 years to accomplish that.
That is awesome. Well, you know what? I saw several of your posts on Facebook and it just drew me in because I had a trunk. I remember for traveling when I would come up from the summers from South Carolina to New Jersey and back and forth. And then my grandmother had a trunk. So just the image and some of the excerpts that you posted on Facebook drew me in. So my question for you is, in your book, you share a lot of traditions common in African-American communities when someone passes. The repast or family gathering at the family home, the food, the various responses to losing a family member, family and friends bringing food. But there was one part that stood out, and that was your experience with Dolores. Can you share this part with our listeners?
Well, okay. Dolores was my grandparents' oldest grandchild. She was only 14 years younger than my own mother, who was the baby of the family. And Dolores had a lot of strength in her. She was so strong that at times it was too much, I thought, for her to bear. She had, when you're talking about being at the funeral, as I start out the book with her husband's funeral, Clarence, and he was her second husband. Dolores's first husband had died when she was 20 years old. He had gotten killed in a car accident. And so she was of the anything you've done, I've had before. She was at that attitude. I can get through this. But I knew that she needed to be comforted. And I think you're talking about the time that at the repast, yes, where everybody else was just talking about and eating and having a good time. And even Dolores was in a wheelchair. She at that time was very, very sick. And I went over to her, knelt in front of her, and I told her, it's okay, you can cry. And She did, but in such a way that it was just, she was really kept everybody from knowing that she was crying, because they would come in to comfort her and she was comforting them instead.
I just thought that was beautiful, because it speaks to how in our community, we always try to be strong. And as women, we try to be there for everybody else and, oh, I'm fine, I'm okay. And I just thought that that was a beautiful portion of your book, where you allowed her space, you covered her, you protected her, and she was allowed to grieve at that moment or have her moment while everybody else was eating or saying, who made this, who made that? But you honed into how she was feeling. I thought that was just beautiful. And it was really touching for me.
Absolutely.
It was something that I was able to share. But one of the things that we did not, we weren't able to get there for, was the wake. There was always a wake in Black community the night before the funeral.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And my father and I had traveled from Philadelphia, so we weren't able to get there for the wake. And she remarked to me, I put them away nicely, didn't I? That was important. That was so important. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So Aunt Dauncey's trunk is vital to the stories and various personalities you share in your book. How did the trunk come into Aunt Dauncey's possession? And what were some of the contents in the trunk? Obviously, don't want to give it all away, but just a little tease.
Well, the trunk itself was something that all of us had a memory of. We were all at Aunt Dauncey's house at various times in our lives that we spent time with her. She was a caregiver for the Harrell family, adults and children. And everybody had, when I asked at the wake, who remembers the trunk? Who remembers what happened? What do you think about the trunk? Everybody had the same reaction, because we all had the same experience. You're not going in that trunk. You're not going in it while she's there. If she's in the room, the trunk is in her bedroom. She has to go in the trunk. She's going to close the door and not let anyone in. And all of us shared that same experience. We tried to sneak around and get peek in the trunk if we could, but she wasn't having it. And what was really the crux of the thing was nobody ever wondered where the trunk came from. We were only trying to figure out what was in the trunk and why she was so protective of letting us see into it. But my father was the one who ended up telling us where the trunk from. And I'm going to tell that part because I think that's interesting to me. Yeah. Okay. But in the trunk, no one went into the trunk until after Aunt Dauncey died. We were all scared to even chuck it after she died. We were scared to go into it.
Well, Elaine, didn't you try to go get into it at one point? And
I did. Everybody did. She had a crutch. Aunt Dauncey was crippled. She had polio when she was 9 years old. So she always walked with a crutch. As she got older, she walked with a walker. And the trunk, she used that crutch for everything. She would make up a bed and use the crutch to help her make up a bed nicely. She would hit the crutch on the floor and say, scat, 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 like you were a cat that pushed you away. But so I tried. I was a little good kid. I was just probably 5 or 6 years old. I tried to sneak and peek in the trunk while she was in it. And she hit that crutch on the floor. Scat, scat, scat. And I ran and fell. Okay. And it was really funny when I look back at it, because I was so scared. I didn't know what to do. But all of us had the same kind of experience. Everybody had their turn as we were growing up trying to sneak and peek a peek, but she wasn't having it. Yeah, it was, everybody had some experience to talk about that trunk and her. But she had things in it. When we did get a chance to look into it, everybody was amazed. Anything that she was interested in, it was like a scrapbook. She did have a scrapbook. That was one of the things. Anything that happened in the neighborhood, in the family, she protected and saved and put it in a scrapbook, or folded it neatly if she had sheets and crocheted things and comforters and things, quilts, things that she would save. But in addition to that, I think she had all her little money as Cash App, and that wasn't available then, but she had her envelopes with the cash according to what she wanted the bills to pay. And there was, when we went through the trunk, it brought back so many memories because she had saved pieces of our lives, and wow, we were able to go back and really review it. And it was really interesting.
That is, and awesome. Who gave her the trunk? I kind of directly.
I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, they got to read. Okay, they're going to find out. This is really interesting. Okay.
Yeah, the trunk, it came to, it was surprising to all of us, okay, where it came from.
Well, as you read that. But, you know, it's funny with, you know, a lot of African-American families, and I'm sure with many families, but particularly with African-American families, there's always the older woman matriarch who's got that stash of cash.
Yes. Yeah.
She could count when she never went to school because of her being crippled and being in the country. So she was educated and she had turned around and taught everybody else too, but she didn't attend school herself. She was homeschooled.
But when you read the book, you find out how wise she was. Definitely.
Yes, very. Exactly.
Okay. In your family, we learned that naming patterns were very important. And so there's one portion in the book can you share, it says why one letter was used for the middle name.
Okay. My grandmother used to keep a book that she was like a black and white composition book that she kept names in. That was anybody in the family that had a child had to go past her to get the name, because she was accumulating names that were different. And my name, actually, my middle name, the T stands for Trevesta. Nobody ever heard of Trevesta, okay? But it's a French name that she thought was pretty. So she wrote that down. And my mother had to ask her for a name when I was born. So, but the fact is, names have always been important in our family. And my grandmother, my father's mother was, from what we understand from oral history, was a descendant of a person who was slaved on Robert E. Lee plantation.
Right.
Okay. And outside of Arlington area. And so the L for the Lee, my father's middle name was Lee, because in those days they named the firstborn child with the mother's maiden name. So that's why you get Hillary Rodman Clinton, the Rodmans being right, the mother's maiden name. Mm-hmm. Okay. So my father's name was James Lee Johnson, and the Lee being my grandmother's, his mother, maiden name. And that was because her family carried the Lee name from the Robert E. Lee plantation.
Wow.
So it became something that we hooked onto, knowing that history. Like I said, it's all oral history. We can't really prove it, but it was oral history passed down to us. And my mother came up with the idea that the L was important. She didn't do it for me. She did it for my brother. And I did it for all of my children. And my brother did it for all of his children. Using an L as a middle of whatever the name was, it didn't matter. We just used the L initial, which is important. It sort of gives a bonding for the family.
Yes.
So so when you're born in our family, if you get an L as a middle initial, knowing that you're not that far removed from the Robert E. Lee plantation, want you to value that, to know that your parents, your foreparents came through that rough time, and to appreciate the fact you got to do the best you can be because you have that kind of strength of having
right,
your legacy. Family endure that. Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So that's why we all, I have my grandchild was married, and his wife was not kind of, wasn't thinking that I was serious when I asked her, what is the L going to be for their baby? My great grand. She didn't think I was serious. He said, yes. He told her, yes, she is very serious.
Very serious. Yes.
Wow. So she was planning to name the baby middle name Alexandra. And so she ended up as Lexandra. She put an L in there instead of starting. Oh.
I think that's very, it's beautiful in that, like you said, having the bonding in the family or oral history or doing something that honors your ancestors and the naming patterns. I just thought that was so beautiful in your book. And actually, I'm listening to you talk about it, although I read it, you know, I'm thinking about names in my own family, and they did that quite a bit now that I think of it. They, you know, using the maiden name of the mother.
Yes, that was done.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Naming patterns. I just thought that was beautiful.
Right.
We actually started something similar too. My grandmother started it because she has sort of a traditional Southern name, which is interesting because even though she was born up north, but her, you know, she's got like the hyphenated Ann, right? So it's Barbara Ann. And from then on, all the girls now, our middle names begin with A.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's like you said, it's a beautiful way to bond and feel connected to the family, and it's a tradition that we started, and you know, hopefully we'll get to continue it. And it's really nice to hear other stories of, you know, other African American family traditions with naming too. So beautiful.
I think that when they realize the why, then they'll continue.
Yes, exactly.
They understand that. Mm-hmm.
So. The experience of your father's relationship with Mr. Lynx, this was really moving. It was really interesting. And you discovered an article that was written about it. Can you share some of that with our listeners, please?
My father grew up in North Carolina, in Reidsville, North Carolina. And there was white families and black families, if they weren't working for them, you know, they weren't friends. Okay. They didn't appear to be anyway. And the young man and my father were about the same age. And so they got to be friends, he being white and my father being black. And they would meet because they knew that their friendships would not be accepted by their friends. And so they would meet on out in the woods or someplace, and actually bond by practicing dancing. They both learned to dance. And in those days, if you were a good dancer, they had dance contests, jitterbugs and stuff like that. So they would learn steps, dance steps, and go each to their own separate places, the dance halls. And he to the white and my father to the black, and they would win contests because they were good dancers and they bonded together in doing that. Nobody knew they did it. This man became a reporter for the Greensboro a newspaper in Greensboro. I don't know the name of it, but it was a well-known newspaper. So he was a well-known reporter. And he actually wrote an article about the friend that society didn't let him have. And he, at that time, they were both in their late 80s. And a friend of ours sent me the article from Reidsville at Newman. And when I went back down there with my father, we actually got this man on the phone. And he and my father acted like time didn't mean anything. They just enjoyed talking to each other for a long time because they had all these shared memories. And it was moving. It really was to know that they could not be friends, but they had managed to have a friendship anyway.
That is a really, really cool story. There was a line you said, something like, you know, Jim Crow didn't win or something like that.
Right.
So, you know, so powerful, you know, and it's sad that got in the way or tried to get in the way of their friendship. But like you said, you know, they spoke and picked up right where they left off.
It was amazing. Yeah. But you could, my father was all crippled up and wearing, walking with a cane, and you could just picture him doing the jitterbug, okay?
But I thought that was a
dancers.
I thought that was a beautiful story, and there were so many, but I was like, okay, we can't, you know, cover the entire book during our interview, but there were so many beautiful, beautiful stories about your family. For our listeners interested in learning about your family, who are two or three people you would want them to know about and the impact they had on you?
Okay. Well, Aunt Donzie is the one who wrote, I wrote the book about. Aunt Donzie was Donzie was not her name. And her name was Velma Leona. And my Dolores, who, like I said, was the oldest grandchild, couldn't say her name. So she said Donzie, at least what that's what I, we can't figure out how Donzie came from Velma. Okay. But that's it somehow. And everybody picked it up. And over the years, everybody in the whole town, neighborhood, family, everybody ended up calling her Donzie, which was really interesting because my grandmother was so much against nicknames. She was so into the name thing. And nickname, if you took the time to pick a name, don't use a nickname, okay? So, but Donzie became her nickname, and everybody only knew her by that. She, I think, was the most powerful woman. And like I said, she was crippled, but she was a caregiver. She took everybody in the family has spent time with her and learned from her. Wise woman with a real good sense of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And she really taught us how to be spiritual. And she was wise. So she would be the one I would pick. Okay. My mother taught me everything I know and was a very good, I became a seamstress and a fashion designer because that's what she did. Okay. And I can remember sitting by her sewing machine and with a needle and thread, and I was hardly big enough to hold one. But so I ended up doing that kind of thing. Influence was there, definitely. And I want to mention Clarence. Clarence was not directly bloodline. He was married into the family. Clarence is the one I start out with his funeral. Right. And what we found out, and this is recent discovery, since I wrote the book, recent discovery, we found out that he is really a hero. And we didn't know that. He was one of 13 plaintiffs in a lawsuit that ended up at the Supreme Court. Unanimous decision. It was Griggs, G-R-I-G-G-S, versus Duke Power. Duke Power was an energy company in North Carolina. And there were 13 Black men who brought a lawsuit with the NAACP.
Wow.
And it's the 8th of March is the 51st anniversary, because last year was the 50th. They found out about it. Someone in North Carolina museum there found out about it, and they honored these people last year. But this year, they're going to honor it even more. They're going to do a bigger celebration of the fact that these men, the lawsuit was what was defining Black the salaries of equal salaries.
Wow.
for everybody. So it's really still in effect. The salaries that Black people, they pulled all sorts of tricks trying to keep from paying Black people the proper wages.
Right.
And this put an end to that. So, yeah, I'm really proud of knowing, having him connected to our family. And we knew something was going on. When I started in the beginning of the book, you can really, that first chapter, understand that I knew something, but we had no idea to the extent it was. That's coming from a generation, what we call the silent generation, that they didn't talk to us, adult conversation. We were all young. They weren't telling us anything. And it really is exciting to learn about it now because his name goes along the list of 13 heroes.
Oh, that's amazing. That is an amazing find. So how do you feel your book would impact the reader?
That's a good question. I hope that there are things you can find in the book that will give you an understanding of what you should or should not do. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are things in there that are obvious that you should not do. One of the things that my mother told me that as it happened, with our, the house that my parents had and her siblings and all had built for my grandmother and grandparents ended up getting lost to an in-law. Okay. And she told me, she was so hurt by that. She says, never, ever trust an in-law to have what you have worked hard for in your family. Even if you're married to a person, don't give them that right to do that. Because it comes down through the family. And somebody has, was trying to keep from even having his wife to pay, help pay for it, ends up having it and it's lost to the whole family. So you read the book, you'll see what that was. It was really, my children actually say, you sure you want to write that? Yes, because it happened. And right. People need to understand and know, okay?
Right.
So that's one of the things I hope that it gives some kind of introspect to analyze things on a wiser basis.
That's a powerful point.
Yeah, and protecting your family legacy, if it's property. I know in our family, on one line, on my paternal line, there's property that's been in our family for over 150 years. Uh-huh. And it is heir property, and you would have a hard time trying to do anything with it. And so we made sure that all of the records are up to date, that the taxes are always paid, and that everything is just the way it should be, so we don't lose it, that we don't lose it to not, you know, for not paying taxes. So I'm proud to say that, you know, is still in our family. So I understand exactly what you're saying, being careful who you trust with your family. Uh-huh. Your family legacy, property, heirlooms, and just making sure that everything is protected.
Yeah, a lot of Black families have lost property from schemes. Okay,
yes.
and taxes being one of the ones that the government ends up getting it. It's we need to be careful. Need to be aware.
Right. So please share some parting words of inspiration to our listeners who may be interested in sharing their personal family history for future generations. And I like, you know, you said that in the book, that one of the reasons that you wrote it was that you're the matriarch, you have the oral history, you verified it, you know the stories, you've talked to a lot of different family members, and you wanted to leave a legacy of the truth about your family history. And I think that that's so important because You know, Shere Khan and I, we talk about this. We belong to a genealogy group and we talk about it, how we wish we had talked to, you know, our ancestors. Like, I wish I'd asked my grandparents more questions than I did. And just building on those stories so that you can pass down a legacy. I've shared this before and I keep sharing it so that if there's anyone that's even thinking about doing their family history, how important it is to talk to your older relatives as soon as possible, that time is of the essence. And there were questions that I asked my grandmother. She was 97 years old when she passed away, and she told me a lot. But even with everything she shared with me, now that I look back, there were additional questions that I wish I had asked her. So I do think that I honor what you have done with your book. It's inspiring to me. I was sharing with Bernice Bennett that your writing style reminded me of her writing style. Okay. And that is, you take the reader on a journey. I felt like I was at every, like it was real. It made me feel that everything was real and that I went on a journey with you. That's how powerful I thought the book was. So in closing, what would you encourage our listeners to do in terms of writing their family history or sharing their family stories, rather?
Okay, that's something that I wish I had done earlier, was to actually start writing things down, because your memory fades, okay, and the details go out. So, and I always thought that I had to wait until I had time, not realizing time don't wait for you.
That's right.
And so I should have started. I could have started. It was no reason I didn't need, I couldn't have started earlier. Even though I thought that I had to be have space of time in my life to do it, I could have taken small segments of it. I could have written in paragraphs and kept going, you know, like if you're running a business, raising a family, teaching, doing all sorts of things, you feel like you're overwhelmed. But I could have written down, washed the dishes and sit down while they're drying and air drying and written a paragraph or something that I'm remembering. I had things in my head, but I didn't put them down. And I'm so sorry. I could have done that. And I've had so many friends say to me after I wrote my book, oh, I could write a book. I got this. I could tell this. Well, they don't. I did. I'm glad that I did. But there are so many people that I come across and say, well, I could do this. I could do that. Do it. Don't waste time.
Right. Don't waste time. That's good advice for sure. Elaine T. Jones, thank you so much for sharing with us and our listeners. This was a great conversation and a really fascinating book. You can find Elaine on Facebook, on facebook.com/Elaine T. Jones. We thank you for joining us, and we look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. Thank you.